This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 7th of February 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 344 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bowne.
On the show today, we'll be hearing from Rod Nordland, Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times and author of a new book called The Lovers that tells the story of two Afghans whose opposing religious backgrounds colour every event of their lives, including their relationship.
And later in the show, we'll be learning why architecture and urbanism can sometimes work best when built from the ground up. Urbanist Lucy Bullivant will be telling us more about her contribution to the Shenzhen Biennale.
And we'll also be looking at art's relationship with technology, the internet and beyond with Emily Butler from London's Whitechapel Gallery. She'll be discussing its major new show, Electronic Superhighway.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Tom Edwards will be here with next week's news. We'll enjoy some good music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
The lark is upon the wing, and here we are on a Sunday morning.
Lark, yes, it's a lark. So,
we're not up with it. I mean, you know, it's midday here, isn't it, Andrew? It's fine. We're not. It's not. It's not like we busted any particular guts to get here. But sometimes, man, it can be tough on a Sunday.
Depends I know
what you've done on a Saturday night. What did you do? There was a cookery book by a well-known friend of the show and chef doing the rounds, yeah. Wasn't there in the office this week?
Well, we should have gone and reveal.
So you've still got. You've got some.
You know, the odd crumb down my face.
Yeah. No,
I cooked dinner for 8 people last night, which is more stressful, I think, cooking dinner. I decided for people than anything else in the world.
Breakfast. Well, you're happy.
Especially if 8 of them have stayed over. Then that's a big breakfast.
That's literally a bun fight.
But let's just say that you were very good with advice. You were able to look at a cookbook. You like cooking.
I do like cooking. And you notice how, and I hope this doesn't necessarily bear itself out in my work persona, but I went for the thing that looked the best but used the least effort.
I know. Mr. Robert Bowne guided me through the cookbook, saying, I'll do this. You can. He was very, very, very useful. So
it's the one egg birthday cake. There's nothing underneath it. Talking of Potemkin villages, should we get out Tom Edwards?
Let's do it.
Who's that moving at the speed of light? Darting around the globe with his golden cape a flutter, waggling his chunky glasses, and giving us a knowing wink as he passes. His cuddly beauty silhouetted against the stars. Who could have such a wise yet pretty face? Or such a wiggly bottom? Could it be? Oh, yes, it's Monocle's very own Clark Kent, our intrepid reporter and all-round lifesaver. And look, he's coming into land. Please welcome the one and only Super Tedwards, the news bear who likes his stories served with ice cream, please. We love you, Super Tedwards.
That must just make you feel good every week about yourself.
There's a sort of a warm feeling that, you know, I've either told myself or that's happiness. I don't know. It's hard to identify.
Well, I hope the chair's still dry when you stand up.
It's just he spilled his ice cream.
Yes.
Where are we going to start with the news?
Yeah. Well, I thought we'd talk a little bit about monkey business, first of all, because I know this is something that's preoccupied us at Midori House in the last few weeks and almost months, because, of course, it is the year of the monkey. Tomorrow it all kicks off. I don't know, we've talked a little bit about it before. I thought it was worth marking. There's going to be a kind of simian quality to the year, evidently.
And we have a little monkey on the cover of our forecast magazines, sitting in an onsen.
Exactly, he features quite prominently.
As you do.
As one does.
Year do you know what kind of animal you are?
I checked this because I thought you might ask me. Year of the horse.
You're a horse?
Yeah. I don't really know what that means particularly. But
what are you, Angie?
Tiger.
Really? Well, what are you?
I'm a snake.
Yeah.
I'm a something snake, though, a fire snake.
Yeah, and isn't...
Which sounds like a rude sexual position.
I think it's Tom Reynolds is an earth snake, which I think makes always think of a worm.
Yeah.
a slow worm.
So am I actual kind of horse? I thought it was just horse. I thought you just had the animal, that's it.
I think if you have some sort of...
I didn't realise there were these varietals.
There's a fire and an earth. I think there are four elemental signs.
Oh.
So I think there's one of those you can sort of...
So I could be like riding a burning horse.
Or you could be like
get some Freudian
or like an ass.
Earth ass. Well, okay. I'll fire ass. I'll find out for next week. I'll find out what kind of horse that I am.
Okay.
I'll share that with you and our lucky listeners next week.
Okay, that's something to look forward to.
Lots of other things going on. Tuesday, Mardi Gras, New Orleans.
Beautiful.
I've never been. I'd love.
No,
it's one
I've
of the sort
been.
Of great events that I'd love to attend.
It seems kind of like one of those things that's still got its kind of original kind of magic there, and it's not necessarily a bandwagon that millions of brands and things have jumped on.
Yeah, well, I don't know what it's like.
I think it's got an idea of pucker and slightly spooky, fantastic.
Yeah, I was going to say a little bit of gothic still. You know, the Anne Rice kind of gothic.
Yeah, like maybe it's a little scary. You're not quite sure.
Totally.
There's a bit of edge to it still.
Yeah,
I'd love to attend, but you know, maybe for another year.
We should come live from the Mardi Gras next year.
Hey, that's a good idea.
Andrew on a big float shaped as a tiger. I can imagine it. Wow.
What was it? Fire Earth Tiger. What kind? What is it again?
I'm just a tiger.
A regular tiger. For the slightly more restrained on Tuesday, it's all the same kind of time of year. You could go to Tuscany for the Viareggio Carnevale.
Oh, yeah.
I don't really know what goes on there, but it's all sorts. But I think this is a bit more salubrious, I think.
Yeah, a little bit more. I think they've all got
Cologne's got its carnival, Rio.
Yeah, exactly. They're all in session at the moment. It's carnival season.
Where would you go? If you could go to anyone, which one would you go to?
Well,
Stockport. Stockport Carnival.
Yeah, I bet there's something good happening there. We don't really do the Notting Hill Carnival. It's not really the same, is it?
Well, it's not really our thing, is it? We have solstice-based events, don't we? We have all that kind of action.
But it doesn't seem to galvanise everybody in the same way. I have trouble with these participatory.
I think we have kind of given up our sort of pagan roots, whereas other people kind of like embrace them.
Yeah.
I mean, the Mardi Gras is all about voodoo, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's why I find that all a bit frightening. Well, I think also, moving on, it's been far too long since we've actually talked about cheese rolling. Now, I know, because we often mention it on the programme.
You're not moving on at all here.
Well, because we mention it in jest as the sort of jokey, esoteric item, but there is an actual proper, the Chester cheese rolling event on Tuesday. So I thought I'd just give them a shout out.
Yeah.
Because cheese rollers from all across the country attend.
I think we need to
do you bring your own cheese, or do they provide you with the cheese?
Do you know what? I think there's different, maybe rules and different classes of rolling.
Yeah.
I wonder if we could enter you in a team next year.
I'd have a bash. Do you know the one I want to do?
Dress him up as the cheese.
Where you chase the cheese down that really steep hill and everyone falls down and breaks their limbs. Not that part of it, but that's one I'd like to try. Is that there's somewhere in the West Country, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think that might be in the summer.
Is it at Cheddar Gorge? Is it somewhere like that? Is it somewhere obvious?
Yeah. You remember, it's absolutely precipitous.
That's terrifying. I mean, I wouldn't ski down it. Even.
Well, and people quite literally throw themselves down it and just trust to good fortune to get to the bottom. I mean,
that would be a way to go, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if anyone's actually perished.
That was a cheese joke.
Oh, way to go!
Whey.
That was literally too intelligent for me.
Okay.
So you need to pitch your jokes at a lower level for me, for them to resonate. A couple of other cultural items, Rob, that may or may not be of interest. Berlin International Film Festival from Thursday.
The Berlinale, always very good.
Berlinale, 66th annual.
It's a scene setter on the calendar.
It's been going since the 50s.
Yeah.
Meryl Streep is president of the jury this year.
Congratulations, Meryl.
That was the sound of underwhelmed.
I love Meryl Streep.
Yeah, she's an old hand. I don't know what she's.
Old hand.
That sounded really offensive.
An old hand
talking
model
about now.
For this movie.
And then I know, again, we mention this every year, and I don't have any audio cues to play in. I'm pretty sure we did this in 2015, but it is, Andrew, your favourite citrus-based event.
It's time for the Menton Festival.
It's rolled around again. The 83rd edition.
Oh, God.
If anyone's anywhere near the beautiful Côte d'Azur, head along. I didn't realise this, Andrew. There's floats decorated with citrus-themed decor. The lemon's the symbol of the city, as Andrew knows only too well. I said that
when we were talking about places on the south of France that were nice and not nice the other day in the office.
And Menton.
And I said Menton was really nice, having been down there for a wedding years ago. And Andrew kind of gave me a bit of an old-fashioned look, and I forgot why now. He wants that place to sink into the sea.
I don't know our listeners. I guess if they delve into the archive, they can find the genesis of this comedy.
Because people are listening to this programme for the first time today, should we fill them in just very briefly on what this is? Perhaps the worst interview ever to be featured on Monocle 24 was the director of the Menton Lemon Festival, or whatever it was. Menton Festival.
Yeah, so first of all, she doesn't realise I'm actually interviewing her. So she's like, she's turning mid-question most of the time to kind of speak to people in the office to ask them,
what's he saying?
It just kind of goes downhill.
Yeah, and it wasn't technically in English either.
No.
Lots of it. Really a highlight from all of M24.
Made me feel very proud of my journalistic skills.
I'm gonna keep raising that every February.
Well, Tom Edwards, thank you very much for all your glorious run through and for highlighting my great career moments.
From Istanbul.
From Hong Kong.
This is Monocle 24.
Tokiosta. Tämä on Monocle 24.
こちらは Monocle 24です。
Questa è Monocle 24.
To Paris. To Munich.
From London.
To Berlin.
To Istanbul.
To Frankfurt.
To Zurich.
To Madrid.
To Singapore.
To Barcelona.
To Toronto.
To Helsinki.
To New York.
To Lisbon.
To Tokyo.
Broadcasting around the world, around the clock.
Monocle 24.
From Midori House in London, you're tuned to Monocle 24.
As international correspondent and Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times, Rod Nordland is a reporter who'll never be short of a story or two. But one particular series of reports, his coverage of Zakia and Ali, Sunni and Shia Muslims from rival religious sects who found love together, represents Afghanistan's complex makeup unlike any other.
Zakia and Ali's story is now the subject of Nordland's new book, The Lovers. And a little earlier, Andrew sat down with Rod to hear about why an act seemingly as carefree as falling in love can take on wider significance in Afghanistan.
Rod, first of all, can you explain to us how you met these two star-crossed lovers?
Thanks to opening my spam folder religiously, I got an email from a woman's advocate in Bamiyan, and she had emailed everybody, every email address of a journalist she could find. So she was in my spam folder. I almost didn't read it because it was one of these long, rambling emails in bad English. But I'm glad I did, because it was just this plea for help for this couple who she said were going to be killed. And the girl was in a shelter, but she wasn't sure how long she could keep them there before her family would drag her out and probably kill her. So I saw it as just a great opportunity to get to an honor killing before it actually happened, and even to talk to all the protagonists and about what makes people want to go to this extreme and motivates them. And also, I thought, possibly maybe prevent it happening by writing about it.
Well, there's lots to pick up there, but let's just tell a tiny part of their story. So they had met as very young children. They were across a Muslim religious divide. They were asked not to kind of be together when they were kind of, growing up, once they passed being children, but they had already kind of fallen in love.
Yeah, and they tried to do it within the bounds of the cultural norms. I mean, he asked his father to approach her father and ask for her hand, and her father absolutely refused, on the grounds that they were different ethnic groups, different races even, and different sects. And they repeatedly tried to press their suit and were turned down, and then she began trying to run away from home and join him, and eventually, ended up in a shelter to protect her from her family's retribution.
And across this kind of, Shia-Sunni divide, I guess when people who don't know Afghanistan, myself included, when you haven't been there, you forget how fractured it is along, tribal divisions, religious divisions. We think of the Afghans, but this is a people with many different ethnic groups, many different kind of, emotions and beliefs pulling them in different directions.
Yes, that's true. At the same time, they have a very strong sense of being Afghans. And both the sect that he came from, the Hazaras, and the sect that she came from, Tajiks, they both practice honor killing. If women do something as outrageous in their view as choose to marry somebody their parents don't agree with.
Now, one of the interesting things for any journalist is that moment when you're not just a reporter. And I know that in the book you raise this issue, and you've raised it outside the book as well. And I know that some of the people who have reviewed the book have wondered about this borderline between you're the journalist, but then you become involved in their stories in very deep ways. You give money to them to help them. You try to do everything you can to sustain them in a way. But still, you are a reporter. You're still going back to tell the stories in the New York Times. How did that unfold for you? And how were there points that made you think,
oh, this is pulling me away from my cold, steely eye of just being a journalist reporting on the facts?
Yeah, that definitely happened. In fact, there was a point at which I knew that I should probably raise some of these issues with my editors, but I also knew that if I did, they would say, okay, you can't do that story anymore. And there wasn't really anybody else who was going to do it. I carried on anyway because I didn't really see at that point, you know, any choice but to do that. I had helped them survive, but it was very clear that they weren't going to survive unless they had continued help from outside. It's a very hard society to hide in, and they weren't doing a very good job of it. And with it, even with my help, in fact, at one point they were captured again, and that very very nearly ended badly. It didn't, but it very well could have.
Now, you talk in the book, and there's a very interesting end part of the book where you go on to talk about the broader issues of women's rights in Afghanistan, about what's happened to other women, and you know, there's a shocking story about a young 10-year-old girl who's raped by a mullah, and the consequences of that. Even her family want to believe that she should be killed in an honour killing. But when you met this couple, what made you think that Zakir and Ali were the people that you wanted to help? What connected you to them? As you say, there are many horrific examples of the mistreatment of young couples. But what pulled you into their tale, do you think?
It's kind of like, you know, the old line about eat your food, think about the starving people in India, and the response is, you know, name one. But when you can name one, you know, it really gets you. And I think it's kind of like that. I got to know them is all, and started to care about them as people, and felt invested in their lives and what happened. And I also felt kind of responsible for what happened, too, because by bringing so much attention to them, the story got just a huge reaction, and both outside of Afghanistan and, more importantly, inside the country. Bringing all that attention to them, you know, created a more perilous situation for them long term. And I kind of felt like that was a situation I created, and I had to, you know, try to make sure it didn't end badly.
And how much for you and for the reader do you think that this is a really nice small snapshot of where intervention from the outside world in Afghanistan has kind of helped? Because you're telling the story against, you know, a terrible backdrop in Afghanistan, you know, of towns falling in and out of the hands of the Taliban. You know, there's the intervention by the West. There's so many outside players involved in the country. And often it just goes horribly wrong. But here's a tale, a single thread through this narrative, which you kind of do the right thing. You go out to help them. Do you feel that the story, the bigger story of the West's intervention and your personal intervention, they tell a similar story, or do you feel that your intervention is a more positive tale than what the West has done?
No, there are a lot of similarities. And, you know, in the way that Zakir and Ali may not have survived without my intervention, an awful lot of other women, including Zakir and Ali, would not have survived without the West's intervention. For instance, the women's shelters that twice protected Zakir from being killed, they didn't exist before the West's intervention. They didn't exist before 2001. And, you know, the Taliban, if they ever took control again, that'd be the first thing they destroyed. And when they took over Kunduz in the north in September, they went right for the women's shelter and burned it down and went looking for the people that worked there. Fortunately, they had escaped. And I'm sure they would do that elsewhere, too. And if they did that, they would have the support, actually, of most Afghans, you know, certainly the majority of Afghans, see women's shelters as something that's against their culture, and they even believe against their religion.
Because when we saw the intervention by the West for the first time to topple the Taliban, there was this narrative of bringing better human rights and especially more rights to women in Afghanistan. We'd seen horrific things happen to people under the rule of the Taliban, but especially the absolute erosion of the, you know, the right of women to be educated, to leave the home on their own, to not be covered up at all times. Now, do you feel that that has been a positive story of the West intervention, or of the West support for the Afghan regime? Do you feel that it has taken proper root? Because you're describing something, on the other hand, that, you know, it can just be swept away in seconds.
Yeah, that's right. It hasn't taken proper root. I mean, I think that so much of it has been artificial in the way that, you know, my intervention with Zakir and Ali was artificial. A lot of what the West has done has been artificial. It hasn't really taken root in the society for a lot of reasons, but mainly because most Afghan men do not believe that women should have any rights. You know, the whole the whole thing that outraged us about the Taliban, that's not what outraged most Afghans, that, you know, their treatment of women, their refusal to allow women to leave the home or to be educated. That did not upset most Afghans. It upset the West a lot more. And since then, we've been very timid in the way we've pushed our agenda in Afghanistan. You know, we've, for instance, insisted that they pass a law for the elimination of violence against women for the first time to, for instance, criminalize rape, which had never been a crime before. But we haven't insisted that they actually enforce that law. And we still pump a lot of money into the country and into programs like that without really demanding that we see some kind of results from those programs.
And there are instances in your book where you have a real impression that, you know, people who we see here in the West as, you know, as kind of enlightened leaders, in the end, they are very uncomfortable with much of this conversation themselves, and they feel that it's embarrassing to Afghanistan to, you know, air these grievances or to talk about, you know, the terrible things that happen for fear that, you know, the West will feel badly about Afghanistan. There don't seem to be many heroes for women's rights, even at the top of the government.
No, I think that's right. You know, Ashraf Ghani has famously brought his wife into public life, which is great. She's a Lebanese Christian, so it's a little easier maybe for her to have that role than, for instance, President Karzai's wife, who was never seen in public. And he's professed, you know, a dedication to women's rights. But when it comes down to the nitty-gritty details, not much has changed because he doesn't have the political capital to make that change. I mean, for instance, the case you mentioned of the 10-year-old girl raped by her mullah, whose family wanted to kill her for that, and then the mullah also then proposed that he marry her to solve the little problem they had of honor. You know, President Ghani never spoke out about that case. And in fact, what he did was bring the protagonists in and create this kind of false narrative that none of this had actually happened. And he even threatened the women's advocates who had prevented that girl from being killed by her family.
Now, we won't ruin the story, but it has many extraordinary twists and turns, and there are moments of humanity, and, you know, that not all of their family believe the same thing. In fact, there are many moments of, you know, realization and changing attitudes throughout the book. But for you, is there a kind of a feeling that you are stitched to their tale for a long time to come?
Yeah, I basically get in contact with them once a week just to make sure everything's okay. It's a little hard to reach them because they don't have a cell phone signal most of the time, but we have an arrangement where they either call us every week or we freak out and start calling relatives and stuff. And they're mostly pretty good about doing that. And so, yeah, I'm sort of stitched to that, that's for sure.
But. And finally, could you tell me, you know, again, without giving away everything, but, you know, the ending, the end point for them, did you many times think, oh, the best thing for them is, you know, two airline tickets to London or two airline tickets to New York? Did that seem to be, you know, as outsiders trying to help, thinking this situation is just so terrible at times, did you think that flight in every sense was maybe the best solution?
I think it is the best solution for them, at least on the sort of short and medium term. I think the ideal thing, and they would like to do this as well, would be that for them to get a visa from a Western country that would receive them and give them asylum. But what they don't want to do is take the route that so many other migrants have taken and risk their lives and the life of their baby now in an attempt to flee across Iran and the Aegean. And they've been kind of dissuaded from doing that. I mean, at one point I said, look, I'll put you in the trunk of my car and take you through Greece if you'd like. But they just backed away. They just saw those images of, like, Island Kurdi washed up on a beach and didn't want to go that way. And I think asked pretty reasonably, if they have such a good case for asylum, why can't we just take them from where they are? Doesn't mean they can't return to their country when the environment's safer. But the fact is that, you know, there are still no cases of honor-killing perpetrators being actually punished for what they do. And there's nothing to stop her family from carrying out the threats that they've made.
But in a weird way, I guess both the agencies that have helped her on the ground, the Afghan government, governments in the West, them remaining there, them not being helped seemingly by the issuing of a visa, it kind of supports the narrative, I guess, for everybody. The Afghan government can say, actually, it's kind of okay for you here. It really is safe. Western governments can say, look, it's not that bad. We've kind of sort of... Do you find that people are shy of helping for what it says about themselves rather than what it says about their lives.
I think that's right. I think, you know, they've created this narrative that we've made lives better for women, and taking them out of the country is just an admission of failure. On the other hand, if they're killed, it's going to be a real setback for that whole cause. You know, they've become kind of heroes to a whole generation of young Afghans who now are starting to speak up for their rights to marry whom they please and to decide on their own lives and their own futures. And if they were killed, it would just be a lesson, well, that, you know, Afghanistan can't change.
Well, it's an extraordinary book based on a series of extraordinary reports. And as we said, a journey which crosses over the borders from cool, hard journalism into something much more extraordinary. The book is by Rod Nordland. It's The Lovers, Love and Vengeance in Afghanistan, a true story.
Time for some new music now from the Dutch musician Annelotte de Graaf, who makes disco-tinged pop under the moniker Amber Arcades. And here she is with Turning Light.
That was Amber Arcades from the Netherlands with Turning Light. And you're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymnbook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Lucy Bullivant is an urbanist, author, critic and lecturer whose work looks not only at how to improve the cities we live in, but also how to let city dwellers take ownership of the spaces around them. Her book, Master Planning Futures, won Book of the Year at the Urban Design Group Awards in 2014. And her recent book, Recoded City, co-authored with Thomas Ermacora, looks at alternative thinking in urban design. She also runs her own site dedicated to intelligent writing on the urban environment. That's called urbanista.org.
She wasn't busy enough. Lucy is currently overseeing Remake We Make, an exhibition pavilion that's part of the Shenzhen Biennale in China until the end of February. The programme looks to highlight the merits of communities working together to make more effective architecture and urban spaces. But urbanism isn't just about putting on a show. Remake We Make is also hoping to have a lasting influence on the local area of Shekou in Shenzhen. And Lucy joins us now to tell us more. So first of all, why Shenzhen? What's your interest in the city?
Well, at relatively short notice, we were given the opportunity to create a pavilion, a thematic pavilion at the what is technically known as the Bi-City Biennale of Urbanism and Architecture, Shenzhen. Shenzhen has always been fascinating to me as being a city in rapid development in the Pearl River Delta. And I thought, in order to respond to their invitation in a way that was viable and exciting for ordinary people, all we would do with our 100 square metres is create an event that basically came out of nothing rather than all there at the beginning. So I got my film director, Paul McGrath, who works for Birmingham Museums, to make a compilation of materials with a soundtrack, which were focusing on social architecture, younger practices like Architecture 00, Studio Weave, Carl Turner Architects, working together with local people rather than for them in a top-down way.
So a window on the world, but bringing in ideas and practices that the local people can use and pick up and run with.
Yeah, I mean, the idea was that the film would also be emotionally engaging. We were very lucky because the other practice was Assemble, who had literally won the Turner Prize just 8 days after we put our show on. But if you watch this space, there will be a design-build workshop that showed the result of working with local people. What we didn't know at the time was who exactly those local people were. So we have two Chinese collaborators, Xin Gao and Yan Guo, who both respectively professors in Hong Kong and Shenzhen universities. They'd been researching the local bodies that we could work with. So they identified this fashion company who ship their goods all over China. And the workers started telling us narratives about their lives and what they liked. What were their preferences? And these are very ordinary people. They're not educated. But they took on board the idea that each one of them would get a grand cylindrical structure made out of knitted textile. So we were essentially, the architects were basically becoming the servants of the workers, if you like. We managed to finish the whole project by the 23rd of January, and then each one of the 11 huge, great cylindrical fabric tubes was displayed within our space. So it now looks like we've got a whole cluster of magic lanterns. What I like about them is they're totally custom designed to the needs and the wishes and the desires of local workers. This type of collaboration between young architects and manufacturing blue-collar workers does not happen very much in Chinese cities. It is still very rare.
And just generally to broaden it out, do you like to work with and in cities that are on their way up or on their way down? Because a lot of architecture biennales and things of this sort seem to be on cities with burgeoning populations, lots of an influx of people, all the rest of it. What about cities, I wonder, that are clearing out, that are not as popular or as wealthy as they used to be?
Well, as you know, it's a moot point whether a city is actually on the way up or on the way down. I mean, obviously Detroit suffered hugely. You know, its main income from the car industry, was that the whole thing is decimated.
Yeah. Is that an interesting place to do your work for yourself? It seems like it might be to me.
I would be quite attracted to going to Detroit. Yeah. And I could, in another world, I could see myself moving from high-priced, overpriced London to a building that costs me maybe only
imagine
a few thousand dollars. I mean, that's what's happening in the States. There's a mass exodus to Detroit. People are making new lifestyles there and getting stuck into the business of evolving new entrepreneurial strategies to help boost the city and help local people.
And just in China, you know, obviously, you know, some of the things that you're talking about here in the exhibition are complicated issues in China. You know, the Chinese government does not like local people being empowered and making decisions about what happens in their communities. They like to have a top-down decision-making process. They don't like people who say, I don't want change. They want people to embrace change. How interesting or how complicated is it when you then, you know, as outsiders come in, you come from Norway, you come from London, and you stir up a little bit of kind of ferment in a way, saying, okay, what do you want your neighbourhood to be like? Why didn't you take control of this process? Is that seen as potentially a little bit dangerous for the people who step out of the shadows and say, I don't like what the government's doing, I want to stop it?
Yes, I can see absolutely that it could be. What I do know is that the young architects that we've collaborated with, they were both trained in one in the States, one in London, and that's actually quite common for people from Southeast Asia and Asia generally to have had a got their first degrees from elsewhere in the world. So they have a certain approach, and what is very strong at the moment is open source design. And I think, you know, whether or not you're talking about transforming a whole neighbourhood or whether you're just talking about, let's say, improving the amenity of a local community hall, creating new furniture, something very modest that can have a catalysing effect because it connects people and makes it easier for them to come
but
together.
But I just wondered on that point, do you feel that the, you know, the people running the Biennale are able to allow a space for, you know, quite a tough little conversation to happen, you know, that what should happen to urbanism in Chinese cities? You know, should it be controlled by local communities or should it be controlled by, you know, the Chinese Communist Party? We've seen, you know, people end up in jail for that kind of tough little negotiation about urbanism, where people, we've seen these images of people remain in a single house because they're the defiant person who wants to kind of hold on to community. Mm. And I wondered if you sensed that when you were there, when you were putting together this exhibition, that, you know, there was a bit of a strong opinion that actually some things that are happening in these cities are just not good.
Well, yes, I absolutely accept your point. And I know these issues, they crop up left, right and centre, and they cause great stress for various people involved. The theme of the Biennale was chosen by the chief curators, who are an international team, you know, one Austrian, one Venezuelan, one American and one local Shenzhen architect, the woman architect, Doreen Lau. Their theme was reliving the city. Their argument was, let's get away from these so-called all-encompassing, abstract, top-down master plans in the modernist tradition, and let's get back to the reality that actually positive change can happen at grassroots level. Now, having said that, there are many implications to that approach that members of the government would take issue with. But I think that there is a great recognition, particularly in contexts like Sheku, which are designated as, they will be areas of creative industry. And there's a great desire in China for further boosting of the use of design, the actual generation of designs by local people as well. So, yes, you can't stop people expressing themselves. And there is always, with the Shenzhen Biennale, there is an element of censorship. The security people come round when everything is ready to be unveiled for the opening ceremony, and they will take down anything. You know, I know two people whose work was censored. In our case, if you ask me that question, why we were not asked to take anything down or change anything. But I think that I go back to purely to the human values of collaboration, the positive psychological effects of collaboration. It may not actually end up in a design result that you want to stick up in the city in a concrete way. But what you can do and leave lasting traces is something which is, above all, is psychological and spiritual. It's not about changing people's minds to foment a kind of a necessarily big-scale revolution, but it's a revolution in their heads in terms of taking part in something and feeling that they are putting forward views of values and being listened to as well.
I would like to ask you a question as, you know, as your job as an urbanist, which is a term that some people, while this programme is going out, will be Googling, obviously, as well.
Not if you present a show about it.
Not if you present a show about it. I wanted to ask you, with your urbanist hat on, actually, what cities do you go to where you can kind of completely relax? Because I guess you're walking down a street, you're thinking of what works, what doesn't. It all feeds into your job. It's a bit like anyone kind of being reminded of their job all the time when they go on holiday, even. Mm-hmm. What cities calm you and make you feel that are cities that are at a very good point right now, that perhaps that don't need to be sort of planned and looked after, that seem to be ticking over nicely in your view?
Well, I went to Seoul in South Korea for the very first time in October and kicked myself that
it's
I never...
It's fun, isn't it?
Seoul, I loved the fact that I could just walk. The walking culture is amazing. I'm walking through the jewellery district, walked around all the gardens of the temples. Yeah, and I felt as a Western woman, I didn't feel in any way conspicuous. When I first went to Japan, I always felt this sort of calm protocol and etiquette.
Yeah.
And then, you know, school kids would come up and say, Gaijin, can I take a picture with you? Calming cities. I think in the UK, Ouseburn in Newcastle, on the east side of Newcastle, where what I considered to be one of the most enlightened property developer in the UK, Igloo Regeneration, have built new housing and are still working very much in Ouseburn. Beautiful place by the water, by the canals.
Well, Lucy Bullivant, from Newcastle to Shenzhen, thank you very much for joining us here on the Monocle Weekly.
Madrid is a changing city. Unlike other Spanish destinations, Madrid hasn't bowed to the tourist hordes in order to weather the economic downturn. Instead, the regeneration has been led by Madrileños themselves. This newly reinvented Madrid is a melting pot of talent, taste, and citywide tenacity. Monocle's editors and correspondents share their discoveries in the new Monocle Travel Guide to Madrid.
If there is one thing to take from this guide, it's that Madrid isn't lacking in colour and diversity, and that's certainly the case for accommodation and hospitality. Hotels have a palpable Spanish flavour to them. Bespoke furnishings are made by local designers, and delicious menus prepared by Madrid's top chefs.
To catch a glimpse of Monocle's Madrid, head to the film section of monocle.com.
London's Whitechapel Gallery's new exhibition, Electronic Superhighway 2016 to 1966, looks at the place where art and technology meet. The exhibition brings together over 100 works that interpret the influence of computers and the internet on our everyday lives.
The show features multimedia pieces from artists ranging from Cory Archangel to novelist Douglas Copeland and unfolds in reverse chronological order, back to the work of pioneers such as South Korean video artist Nam June Paik, who in 1974 coined the phrase from which the exhibition takes its name. Rob met with Emily Butler, assistant curator at Whitechapel Gallery, a little earlier to hear a bit more.
Emily, thanks for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. First of all, this show, Electronic Superhighway, in its literature, attempts to answer a question at least, which is how has the internet changed art? Now, that's something I'm not going to ask you, thank God, on today's show. But maybe you can give us an idea, with a couple of works, kind of the pace of the show and of the tone of the show, how you're attempting to answer that question.
So Electronic Superhighway is a very ambitious show. It really looks at how the internet and computer technologies have influenced art. And we're not just looking at how it's influenced art today, but I guess we're reflecting on how it's influenced it over the past 50 years, because it's really difficult to kind of look at that question now. I mean, there's a huge wealth of material online that has inspired artists. So it's kind of, we're using history as well as a filter to try and understand the present. So the exhibition really charts how the internet and computer technologies have influenced artists in terms of providing lots of tools, such as artists using, you know, Facebook from Twitter, facial recognition software issues on Facebook, but also how they've reflected on the breadth of material that's available to them in terms of imagery, etc.
And it's an interesting one. So you've gone, and also the subtitle is 2016 to 1966. You're kind of going back to the future, or to the, you know what I mean.
Somehow. Yeah, exactly.
So you walk into the show, and we see the most contemporary stuff, and we go back in time. For how long did you have to tussle with that notion? Was that always set in stone that would be the curatorial path on which you would take your visitors?
No, I think at the inception of the project, we were really looking at tackling what is this complex question, which is, how has the internet influenced us? It's influenced us in so many different ways. It's influenced the way that we think, we feel, that we communicate. And artists have responded to this in many different ways through photography, painting, installation, video, etc. So it's quite, a very broad and complex issue. So it was actually through, thinking about the genealogy and thinking about precursors, important figures such as Nam June Paik, who actually coined the term electronic superhighway, that we actually thought it was really important to offer a historical dimension to the show.
And I wanted to flag up a couple of my favourite pieces in the show, actually. Celia Hempton's work's great. But I wanted to talk first about Trevor Paglen's Cube, an autonomy cube.
Yes, exactly.
And this is a server which you can log onto when you walk into the gallery. You can use your smartphone and log onto it and be anonymous in the internet, which is obviously a very rare commodity these days. This seemed to be kind of one of the leitmotifs of the show, one of the kind of standout works. What was it like getting these works into the show? I mean, by the agreement of the artist and the gallery or private collections, how did that side of things work?
Well, I think a lot of the artists were really happy and enthusiastic to be included in the show. I mean, it's a very important question that hasn't really been addressed by other institutions before in London. I mean, there's some other exhibitions that are on at the moment that tackle issues such as data, but actually reflecting on the what the impact sociologically and psychologically the internet has is something that art's in an amazing position, a privileged position to do. An artist can really help us reflect on issues, as you were just saying now, of data control, surveillance, the question of representation, the relationship between the analogue and the physical worlds. And so that's why we chose most of these artists in the show.
And some of these things almost feel like if you were putting together a commercial gallery show and you were commissioning artists to do work for it, they would be perfect, like the Celia Hempton one. Maybe you can talk us through that, because that seems like her work seems at the cusp, or at least her work in your show at the Whitechapel seems completely indicative of the kind of message, maybe the message that you're trying to give, but of the blurring of the line between old and new art or on and offline art.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think a lot of the times people think of internet art as something that just happens online, but actually the influence that the internet has on artists is through all sorts of different media, including traditional ones, and in this case, traditional oil painting. So what Celia Hempton has done as this series is that she has painted portraits of various strangers that she encounters on chat roulette, and the painting sessions actually only last as long as the conversations last, so, you know, sometimes seconds, sometimes minutes. And she is really rethinking the canons of portraiture and painting through, you know, these kind of instantaneous online encounters. There are other examples of artists in the show who rethink the traditions of painting, such as Petra Courtright or Jonas Lund, whose amazing viewer-improved painting is actually kind of two digital screens that reconfigures itself according to the desires, that is, by tracking the gaze of the viewer looking at it.
And I wondered how didactic and how relaxed and how much you wanted the visitor to make up their own mind about the political nature of some of these things, because there is the politics of economics in Jeremy Bailey's work, for example. How did you decide the right amount of nudge to give your visitors?
Well, I think in general at the Whitechapel we don't try and kind of over-explain works. I mean, it's a complex show because by its very nature, there's just so much material. I mean, in a way, it's meant to be overwhelming, and I don't think you're meant to necessarily understand everything, because obviously we're looking at the present, which is, you know, always very hard to analyse from your current position. It's always easier in retrospect. But obviously we've also offered, you know, some key information on wall labels and on additional material to guide the visitor. And I think the most important thing is also to talk about the work. You know, that's a very important aspect of what we do at the gallery in terms of offering tours, etc. So to actually just discuss the pieces.
Yeah, and in a way, I mean, it's sort of an old-fashioned show using cutting-edge art. Did it have to be that way in order to kind of make sense of it? Because you could have pretended the Whitechapel was a phone shop or the offices of Google or something deeply naff like that. But I mean, you've gone for quite an old-fashioned layout in order to presumably to show people what cutting edge is and how different those things are, maybe.
I mean, one of our galleries does actually look a little bit like a computer shop, which is our gallery that's dedicated to net art. But, yeah, I mean, I think what was really important about the show was that, you know, whilst people often think of digital art as being something that exists online, actually, you know, the show aims to show how artists are engaging in this physically and commenting on it. And actually, there's nothing that replaces the experience of seeing and thinking about art in the gallery space. And that's one of the key messages of the show, is that, you know, artists engaging in the subject matter, but, you know, you've really got to physically encounter it as well.
One of the things I liked was the fact that it's quite on the bottom floor as you enter the show. It's quite a cacophony of noise and images, actually. There's a lot of things coming at you, And that was that a conscious choice? Because it kind of reflects the cacophony of the internet. It almost feels like you're victim of a pop-up.
Exactly. It's what I was saying earlier about, you know, seeing how the art has been influenced in so many different ways. So it's very bright, it's very noisy, you know, you can hear works interfering and or actually kind of being in dialogue with each other. And upstairs, you know, the show has a different feel as well. You know, looking more at the historic works, it starts taking on a bit of a more museal feel. And, you know, that's obviously intentional as well. It's kind of taking a more reflective analysis, a more selected analysis of historic works.
And just finally, a note on the art market. There's always a statistic, or it's a kind of anecdote that's trotted out by critics of of the way the art market works in our sort of art fair centric world, where, you know, 67% of works are sold on the strength of a JPEG on an iPad by a dealer at an art fair of something that's actually back in his warehouse that isn't on show there. Did you want to tackle that, or did you want to leave the market out of it?
I think there's some works on certain artists that comment slyly on the market. Mm. And I mean, another case in point is Jonas Lund, whose work I mentioned earlier is about, you know, the improvement of painting through the viewer's kind of interaction with it. But he's also made a lot of work that actually attempts to create algorithms of taste. The market is something that's intrinsically linked to the subject of contemporary art. But I think the aim of the show is really just to let the art speak for itself, and to think about how actually art has been able to kind of bypass the market in a way by being so much more widely available to the general public. So kind of, you know, the utopian possibilities of the web is also kind of hopefully something that comes out of the show as well.
Do you wish you'd called it Algorithms of Taste now? Slightly.
No, I love the title Electronic Superhighway. It's right. Delightfully vintage.
It is. Emily, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Rob talking to Emily Butler from the Whitechapel Gallery about Electronic Superhighway. Beep, beep. A little bit earlier.
All right, Andrew, there we are. Edition 344 of the Monocle Weekly. Man alive, they keep on coming up, don't they? Like speed bumps in the road of life.
Yes, a very nice show. And I'm sorry we didn't get to it. Sometimes
it's a bit bitty, wasn't it?
Yeah, sometimes we have to kind of meet people at different points in the week to make sure this all goes smoothly.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we weren't always together. And I hate to be divided from you.
Regular listeners might think we've kind of fallen out, but we haven't, have we? It's fine. Everything's fine.
We love each other. So should we
let's play out with Heal the World by Michael Jackson. One of my favourites.
Why not? Or, even better,
thank our pals.
Yes, because it's the end of edition 344 of the Monocle Weekly, isn't it, Rob?
It certainly is, Andrew.
Who should we thank first?
How about Tom Hall, our producer?
And also Claire Manager.
Claire Manager. Who's Claire Manager? She's like a sort of fictional female also, football manager. Claire Manager. I've seen the look on his face.
And also our studio manager was Claire Urban.
And the Monocle Weekly, of course, will be back at the same time, same place next week. But for the time being, for me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tug.
Thanks for tuning in.